Welcome to Pedo Teeth Talk, brought to you by the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, a podcast show that delivers cutting-edge ideas for the professionals specializing in pediatric dentistry.
Thank you for tuning in to Pedo Teeth Talk, where we bring you the contemporary issues important to you and your practice. Brought to you by the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry. I am your host, Joel Berg. Thank you to our Pedo Teeth Talk sponsor, Hugh Freedy, for helping us bring you great content. We couldn't do this without them. Visit them at www.hughfriedy.com. That's H-U-F-R-I-E-D-Y.com. We're here today with Thomas Terranova, JD, MA, MBA. He's the Executive Director of the American Association for Accreditation of Ambulatory Surgery Facilities, or AAASF, or Quad A. And we were just talking that they don't answer the phone that way for obvious reasons. But the AASF has become very important to us in pediatric dentistry that we'll hear about during today's podcast. During his tenure at Quad A, Tom has led numerous triumphs for the organization, including year-long Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, review that was instrumental in continually improving the Quad A CMS performance measure scores. In addition to introducing many process improvements and innovations, Terranova, who was able to contract with one of the largest life safety code organizations worldwide, setting Quad A SF apart from other accrediting organizations. Prior to becoming executive director, Tom has served as the interim chief operating officer, director of accreditation, and director of legislative and external relations. So, Tom, we're so glad you're here with us today. And I think, you know, the APD in recent years has recognized the importance of safety. And I think through our safety committee, we've reached out to you and your organization, and we're starting to work together. So thanks for being with us today on Pedo Teeth Talk.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
So to start out, I alluded to your long acronym, but maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about AAASF and the history of it, why it's needed, just a little bit about the organization.
Sure. Well, so first of all, the most efficient way to refer to us is Quad A. It comes across a little odd in audio, but once you kind of know the acronym behind it, Quad A makes a little bit more sense. But if you just tell people that cold, they get confused. The organization started about 41 years ago, 1980, and essentially was brought about by the fact that basically the first person narrative that I heard from some of the founding members was people who were doing surgery or procedures with anesthesia in their offices back then were sort of risking their licenses. It was sort of a frowned upon practice. And so they needed some mechanism to really show that they were doing things right, that they were safe, that they were conscientious, that they weren't cutting corners, and they weren't just kind of, they didn't have this sort of Wild West mentality about how they were going to practice medicine or dentistry or whatever the specialty might be. And in many cases, they needed to go to the office because either hospitals or other settings, they weren't able to get onto the surgery schedule. And so in 1980, we were founded as a nonprofit organization. We remain a nonprofit organization with the mission of advancing patient safety. And so the endeavor basically remained voluntary through most, I would say, the first half of its life. So it was a smattering of individuals who were probably already doing things right, right? And they just needed some sort of demonstration that they were doing things right and a certificate to hang on the wall. And so they created and proliferated this national organization to show and demonstrate their commitment to safety. And then somewhere in the mid-90s, other organizations started to kind of take notice, whether that be specialty societies, Medicare, Medicaid services, as we said, CMS, and some states. And so around 97, 98, Quad ASF became a Medicare deeming authority. It was called a Medicare deeming authority, meaning essentially we conduct surveys rather than the state surveying agency to allow facilities to qualify as an ambulatory surgery center and get Medicare, Medicaid funding and payments. Same time range, both of the major plastic surgery societies in the United States decided that all of their members would have to commit to operating only in licensed hospitals and ASCs or accredited offices as a kind of a commitment to their quality and safety. And so that was a big kind of watershed moment. And then Again, right around the same time, the state of California enacted the first law mandating accreditation in the practice of medicine in this case. And so that sort of begat a diversification of specialties so that now multiple different types of facilities were coming to become accredited rather than just those sort of volunteers who were already maybe the cream of the crop. And so throughout then this latter half of our development, now we've started to become much more diverse in terms of specialties, in terms of the numbers of people that we represent in terms of accreditation, and in the number of programs that we provide. So now we have 3 Medicare approved programs, ambulatory surgery centers being the first, but also outpatient physical therapy, which covers occupational therapy, speech therapy, and physical therapy, as well as rural health clinics, which provide really cradle to kind of cradle to grave care, primary care in rural communities and health provider shortage communities throughout the country. We have urology, gastroenterology, oral surgery, dentistry that now make up large portions of our demographics and our population. So we've really become much more diverse in what we're doing, and we accredit pretty much, you know, coast to coast, all 50 states, some of the U.S. overseas territories, and then about 17 countries around the world as well. The thing that has remained consistent is sort of our sort of scientific and academic commitment to safety, and that being our overall driving force. I can tell you our board, our leadership, our staff are so committed to patient safety that, you know, we often sacrifice sort of members for the sake of safety, because that's our job. We ultimately see our client as the patient. Right. So that's really what we try to stick to. And I, you know, we'll start with it as kind of the reason why we are who we are and where we are. I think we just shared a terrible, terrible story of a 3-year-old boy, I think it was in Kansas, who just passed away. I think it was yesterday or the day before we had the news article, and it was a sedation case in which the patient passed away. And that's really our mission, is to mitigate and prevent cases like this as much as humanly possible.
Yeah, when you first started telling the story, Tom, of how the organization started, it sounds very similar to, you know, dentistry, what's going on today. I wanted to ask you, it's obviously just a quick and obvious question, but what does accreditation mean, and what does it get you in this sense?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of quick things that accreditation means, and I can't agree with you more about the parallel, and I, you know, hopefully we can explore that a little bit more. But accreditation really is, you know, there's this setting. You know, you're giving care in a setting, and in this case, the dentist is the primary caregiver, but there's a whole lot of components that go into that. And often that's something that there's a huge knowledge asymmetry with patients, right? So patients don't know the 600 or 700 questions that we essentially ask or investigate on a survey. But we're talking about things like record keeping, personnel record keeping, the training, not just of the dentist, but the anesthesia provider, nurses, general safety kind of training, like, you know, fire drills and use of the fire extinguisher and all the other things that go into safety, as well as maintenance of the facility, how sterility is maintained and proper cleaning and disinfection techniques. So all of these things that go beyond just the primary proceduralist's training and expertise, which is incredibly important, but is one incredibly important component among many others. So that's really what accreditation is and what it means. And the value that it brings then is this sort of demonstration of safety. And, you know, unfortunately, I can't give a ton of statistics on it because we're in the middle of a huge research project that we're doing. But, you know, we're already seeing in some of this research project that we're working on, you know, a tremendous differentiation with patients where accreditation and that statement, that easy question, is this place safe? You know, it makes a huge difference in patient decision making.
Yeah, and I think we're familiar with accreditation. All of our dental educational institutions are accredited ultimately by the U.S. Department of Education, which authorizes the Commission on Dental Accreditation in this instance to do this. And I think the goal is to improve quality and safety and quality. And I think we see that in what your organization offers. I know a lot of us work in hospitals as pediatric dentists, and we're familiar, therefore, with JCO, the Joint Commission, and their other accrediting agencies. I've been involved with unannounced visits and things like that. So how would you compare yourself between that accreditor, JGO specifically, and what you do?
Yeah, so without singling out any other entity, I like to talk about us, but obviously JCO is the one that most medical dental professionals are most familiar with because of the hospital training environment, and so it's a natural sort of how do you compare to them? But there's a number of accreditors in every different setting, and there are a few things I think that just truly set us apart. So one being what I said before is sort of an academic and almost scientific approach to accreditation that allows us to be very cut and dry, very kind of dogged in our commitment to patient safety, that in my opinion is sort of on another level. We have, first of all, 100% compliance mandate in our accreditation, meaning some of the other organizations will allow a certain number of deficiencies and they'll offer sort of advisory opinions and suggestions. We don't do that. We try to write our standards as clearly, concisely, and binary as possible. So if a facility does exhibit any deficiencies on their survey, we expect that every single deficiency would be corrected before we confer accreditation. And the method by which we do that is also a stark differentiator, because to my knowledge, every other accrediting body and licensing body will accept simply a plan of corrective action from the facility. We actually go a step farther and collect evidence of compliance. So we want to see that that corrective action was actually taken. So that takes us another step farther in terms of ensuring compliance. The other things quickly that I would say is we have a really rigid adherence to scope of practice integrity. Mm-hmm. We have really comprehensive standards that require the practitioner to be providing care only that they are specially trained for, that they have their specialty mm-hmm. training covers, and that they have the appropriate privileging to maintain and to perform. And then finally, we also have patient safety data reporting, which collects comprehensive data from every facility we accredit around the world to be able to provide infection rates, hematoma rates, any kind of adverse event that you can think of rates, so that we have some really concrete data to prove out the safety of the facilities of your credit.
Yeah, that's good information. We will now pause for a word from our sponsor.
Hugh Freedy is the global leader in dental instrument manufacturing and infection prevention solutions that keep you performing at your best. For more information on Hugh Freedy products, visit hughfreedy.com/AAPDcrowns. That's hugh-freedy.com/AAPDcrowns. And enter the promo code 2682 if placing an order for Pedo Crowns.
We are back with Tom Terranova. We're talking about accreditation and the quad organization that he heads. To help us do that, the Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, in response to requests from our safety committee, has reached out to your organization, Tom, and we're talking about working more closely together. Let's continue and talk about the importance of accreditation to the patients. Ultimately, it's about safety, especially when you're dealing with children. So give us a sense of how the accreditation and the work that you do does indeed improve safety for children.
Sure. So the first thing, and it kind of goes back to what we talked about, is the differentiators. The very first thing, and probably the biggest differentiator and assurance of safety, is to make sure that those performing cases are supremely trained and qualified to do so. So we have, as I said before, really strong standards around the training, the specialty, resident, all those great things that medical and dental professionals do, to make sure that we don't have people providing care for which they're not trained supremely for. And we don't judge technique ever. We just want to make sure that everyone has those qualifications. That's when we go beyond then. That now we're looking at the training of the staffing, the how things are, the policies, the emergency preparedness. So one thing is to mitigate risk, right? One is to make sure that bad things don't happen. But we know that there is some inherent risk in some procedures. And so the secondary step there is to make sure that the facilities are supremely prepared to deal with those emergencies when they do occur, meaning appropriate emergency drugs, appropriate emergency response equipment, training, drilling, all of those policies and procedures, and that there's a tremendous amount of familiarity with the staff. If you're bringing in per diem nurses or you're bringing in contract anesthesia, are they familiar with the facility, the floor plan? What processes do you carry out to orient them? And so we use both the proactive step of trying to mitigate the chances of a adverse event, but also the ability to mitigate the outcome of if God forbid one does happen. And so that's really where the benefit comes to the patient. And then it assures the patient that you've done everything you can do. And it allows the society to say that they've been more proactive and that they have been doing everything in their power to stop these bad events from happening or to avoid them, rather than simply investigating and trying to do the best thing possible in a reactive fashion.
You know, I'm thinking about accreditation back in when I was involved as the dental director of a large children's hospital. We had built a new facility and we had the privilege of visitation by Don Berwick, then the CMS administrator. And because we were part of the hospital, technically, we were required to follow the JCO accreditation certification. And the thing that impressed him most when he came into one of our surgery rooms was the checklist. And so when I think of, you know, there's a book called Checklist Manifesto, which I love. I'm a big fan of checklists. Pilots use it. A lot of safety training for dentists and physicians is from pilots. We have a lot of similarity. Maybe you could talk about, you know, the result of kind of a self-study that one would do to be prepared for accreditation, and how that relates to the creation of these checklists to prevent adverse events from occurring.
Yeah. First of all, I can't agree more. And I think, you know, I think the safety meeting that the AAPD put on a couple of years ago featured, I think it was a pilot and astronaut that talked about the checklist kind of culture and what it did for aviation. Right. And I think
it's
a parallel that we draw all the time as well. You know, when people kind of grumble about some of these checklists, I say, okay, imagine that you were getting on a flight and the pilot didn't go through the checklist. Would you want to stay on that flight?
Right.
It's the same question. And
yes,
and we really think the same here. And so, one thing that I always advocate is to get the standards and then objectively look through your facility and assess it as though you are a surveyor, not as though you're someone who's working in there every day, because we become kind of blind to our routines. And checklists are wonderful because they help you through it. We try to minimize them as much as possible, but strike that balance, because when you talked a little bit about JCO and the hospitals, when you have something that's built for such a large institution with such a big hierarchy, you can sometimes, the fit can be difficult to manage when you're scaling down to a smaller operation. And no matter what kind of pieces you choose to excise, the fit's never going to be glove-like. So we try to really be glove-like in our fit to smaller 2, 3, 4, 5 practitioner practices, where you need to balance that. And you have these checklists that are efficient and not overkill, that allow you to make sure you're doing the right things without kind of over bureaucratizing the system.
Sure. Yeah.
And we offer a lot of checklist templates and things like that as well. But that's essentially what, you know, everyone's trained to provide care and to diagnose and to treat. This is like the kind of the nuts and bolts that go into it. And the checklists, whether they be from cleaning, processing, you know, pauses and timeouts and things like that, all of those things are critical to making sure that what was supposed to be done was done. And that's really how the survey goes.
Yeah. I mean, we now check IDs of patients when they come back to make sure you have the right one. I think, which to your point of scaling down, you know, most pediatric dentists are in small groups, although we are creating these large group practices that are evolving quickly around the country and in dentistry as a whole, and also in pediatric dentistry. So how does your model fit into the small office? So if I'm just one person, or if I'm 2 or 3, do I still need to be accredited? Is there a big advantage, or is the advantage really for more for larger offices where you have all these credentialing issues and quality issues?
Well, you know, I think the inverse is probably true, is that it's more important for the smaller facility, right? Because there's a few reasons why. One is really the risk comes in most cases is that nexus of treating the patient, especially when you're using the anesthetic, sedation, or whatever. You know, there's that's really what most cases, if a state's going to regulate, they're looking at use of sedation or higher. They don't really care how big the facility is. So that's the one component of it, is sort of a compliance issue with the risk. The other side of it is big organizations tend to have a little bit more, I don't want to say waste, but they have more bandwidth, let's say, to be able to like to have oversight, to have governing bodies. Where I find trouble can rear its ugly head is in a solo practice, right? They do things based on, because doctor said so, right? Because doctor said we want to do this, or doctor said this. There's no committee meetings. There's no committee minutes, because, well, who's going to be in that committee meeting other than, you know, the practitioner? So here, accreditation kind of graft itself on and provide a little bit of a structure where it's very easy to be structureless. And so I think it can be very important there, because you kind of force the hand, you force the facility's hand to not waste time, but to say, here's the processes you really need to follow, and not just kind of be a little bit laissez-faire about it and say, well, now we're going to do this policy or that policy because that's the way I like it done. We're going to put it to paper. We're going to put pen to paper so that we can check up on it and verify. And I think that's critical. And I will say that's where the fit becomes important.
Yes.
For us, accreditation is supposed to be as much about the patient as possible. So we try to minimize that bureaucracy, but kind of inject the appropriate amount to the facility so that it's useful. And what we found, we did a survey, gosh, this may be 5-6 years ago now, but about half of the facilities that we worked with successfully achieved accreditation with a consultant, and about half just did it internally. And the lion's share of our facilities are 1, 2, maybe 3 practitioners.
Okay.
So and it was completely manageable with or without a consultant. It was just a business decision by them.
Yeah, I think that's a good point on the small practices. And I think that a large group, regardless of discipline, has an easier time demonstrating quality because they have the wherewithal to create processes and systems and metrics. Whereas the small practice perhaps they do have those metrics, but it's harder to demonstrate them to the public, to the patients. So I think
sure. And yeah, let's also take a cynical eye. If I was say, you know, if say something did go wrong and you're kind of now dealing with someone who's very cynical and kind of putting the hot spotlight on a facility or on a practitioner, if it's a solo practice and they've granted themselves privileges, what does that privilege granting process look like, right? So our accreditation process, because it is designed for smaller facilities, has sort of an external privileging kind of aspect to it that allows you to lend credence to saying, look, I am supremely qualified for this. I didn't just take a weekend course in X, Y, or Z and feel like I'm confident in it and feel like I'm a well-meaning, competent dentist and I can do these procedures and therefore I'm going to start doing it, right? If it's a solo practice, you as the director can give yourself privileges to do what you want. The accreditation kind of formalizes that a little bit more to give it some more credibility and credence.
This is great information. You know, as we're concluding here, I have to ask you, you know, because we're all emerging now from the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, and obviously that's had an impact on everything. How has it impacted your business and the business of accreditation?
So it's been interesting because we've certainly had to delay a lot of our on-site surveys, but I would say we've probably worked more in the last year and a half supporting our facilities than we had ever in the past. Because in most cases, as an accreditor, people kind of want you out of their hair. You know, you're coming around to tell them what they're doing wrong and how to fix it. And they kind of don't want to deal with you for the next 3 years if they don't have to. But with COVID, everyone was really kind of really needing information. So we produced about a 50 or 60 page resource guide for facilities in English and in Spanish, about with scripts, with templates, with how to adjust your timing policies and cleaning and infection control. And so I think that really helped facilities. We even gave them signage. You know, we kind of helped find the signage that they would need and, you know, changing temperature taking and all of these sort of questionnaires that have unfortunately become second nature to us. But the other thing I think that it's really important, and I think we all need to be aware is patients now are infinitely more familiar with the principles of infection control than they have ever been in their entire existence as patients. Everybody knows about masking. Everybody knows about hand hygiene. Everybody is policing their neighbors and their friends, and they're going to police their healthcare providers. I am very confident in that. You know, they will know what it means to disinfect thoroughly, what hand hygiene looks like and masking looks like.
Well, I think that, not to interrupt, I think it's a perfect example of where dentistry is ahead of the game. And to my point earlier about, you know, maybe we're doing something well, we need to demonstrate, because historically when they did surveys of hospitals, you know, way before COVID, of who's washing their hands when they enter the patient's room, the compliance was actually quite low. And this is a national statistic. Whereas in dental offices, we're already washing our hands in every visit So we didn't actually change that much. We changed maybe a different kind of mask, but you know, the evidence is showing that the patients benefited from our stringency. So I think accreditation could help demonstrate what we're already doing in some instances, although enhancing in other areas.
I would agree with that. I think it provides an opportunity to create the dialogue and sort of seize control of the dialogue. That's where I think the issue is, right? Is when bad things happen, the dialogue's beyond your grasp. So here's to seize control of that. And I just want to touch on a point that you made, and I'll do it really quickly. We did find something very similar, just because of the proximity to the face, dentistry and ophthalmology kind of got grouped a little bit together in this. And the doctors and the dentists were kind of doing very similarly good things on their end. One of the interesting little findings, though, was a lack of disinfection on the patient side of some of the barriers. So that was one of the interesting things with COVID that we found was that, you know, the dentists and the doctors were doing and the nurses and the technicians were doing everything right on their end. But any of these sort of barriers to keep the provider and the patient, there was a little bit more room for improvement on the patient side, where patient after patient were going up to the same surface or going up to the same barrier. And that was the big COVID risk in those specialties, which was slightly different than the other specialties.
Yeah, we learned a lot for sure, and we'll continue to. Well, Tom Terranova, thanks so much for being with us today. And how can we get in touch with you if we're interested in thinking about accreditation?
You're great. Yeah. So first of all, thank you for having me. It's a great opportunity to talk to the specialty. And if anyone wants to reach out to us, obviously the website is great for us. It's www.aaaas, like surgery, F like facility, .org. My email is tterranova, tterranova, @aaaasf.org. And we actually have real life people that answer the phone most of the time. So you could also call us at 847-775-1970.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Pedo Teeth Talk today, where we bring you the contemporary issues important to you and your practice, brought to you by the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry. We'll see you here next time.
Do you need additional CE hours but don't have time to travel to courses? Did you attend annual session and want to listen to the audio recordings? Check out AAPD's new Education Passport. The redesigned and improved Education Passport is AAPD's online learning center, where you can earn CE and listen to audio recordings from all of our continuing education courses and more. Visit educationpassport.aapd.org for more information. For 10% off any product, use discount code TEETHTALK in the Education Passport store.
Pedo Teeth Talk is brought to you by the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, the show that delivers cutting-edge ideas for the professional specializing in pediatric dentistry. If you have any questions or comments, please email info@aapd.org. We welcome your ideas for future shows and guests. For more information on the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, visit aapd.org.